Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome back. So today we're doing a deep dive into what feels like a really core argument, actually, David DeGrazia's Animal Rights. It's a book that presents a powerful moral philosophy.
Yeah, powerful is the right word. And, you know, it's intellectually quite demanding in places.
It really is. And our mission today really is to unpack that philosophical case, why many animals might have fundamental rights moving beyond just, you know, feeling sorry for them.
Right, beyond sentimentality.
Into actual logical consistency, because we face this huge, maybe uncomfortable question all the time, don't we?
Right.
When we eat, when we shop.
Oh, absolutely. It's that core problem of moral inconsistency, isn't it? Mm. I mean, look at how we treat our pets. We shower them with care, expensive vet visits, special food.
Yeah, they're family for many people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And yet, simultaneously, our society supports systems that exploit billions, truly billions, of other animals, pigs, chickens, cows, animals in labs.
Often for reasons that seem, well, trivial in comparison. Convenience, taste.
Precisely. And it's that jarring contrast, that dissonance that DeGrazia really zeroes in on.
He forces us to ask, fundamentally, what do we owe animals morally? And why do our current practices often feel so illogical?
It's a question of justice, he argues, not just about being nice or ensuring basic welfare.
So who is David DeGrazia? Why should we take his argument so seriously?
Well, he's got serious credentials. He's a distinguished professor of philosophy, also holds an appointment in bioethics at George Washington University.
Ah, so he bridges theory and practice.
Exactly. That's his specialty, taking dense philosophical ideas and applying them to messy real-world situations. Bioethics, moral theory.
Yeah.
That's his playground.
Which is probably why the book feels so rigorous. It's not just an emotional appeal, right?
Not at all. That's what makes his perspective stand out. It's built on philosophical rigor. His background, particularly in bioethics, lets him handle really complex stuff, like, say, animal experimentation, with a lot of nuance.
He doesn't just dismiss opposing views, then.
No, quite the opposite. He engages with them fairly, acknowledges complexities, human benefits sometimes. But then he carefully, meticulously builds this case for what he calls a common ground animal rights position. It feels very balanced.
Okay, so let's get into that core argument. What's the central premise of the book?
Fundamentally, he argues that our traditional way of thinking about ethics, which is very human-centered or anthropocentric.
Right, focused on us.
Is flawed, especially when deciding who gets moral consideration, who counts morally.
So what should the basis be, if not human traits, like rationality or language?
He says those are arbitrary lines to draw. They basically just serve to keep humans in a special category.
Okay.
Instead, he argues the foundation should be sentience.
Sentience, the ability to feel.
Exactly. The capacity to experience things like pleasure, pain, suffering, enjoyment. Having subjective states. If a being can feel, if it can be harmed or benefited in ways that matter to it, then it has moral status.
That seems simpler, but also much broader.
It is. And the book takes you on this journey. First, he lays out the scientific evidence for animal minds, for consciousness.
Right.
Then he applies major ethical theories, like utilitarianism and rights theory, to that scientific reality. And finally, he looks at the practical consequences for farming, for research, even for pets.
And what's the big takeaway, the kind of core insight?
I think the real game changer is his conclusion that just focusing on animal welfare isn't enough.
Meaning just making sure they're treated humanely while we use them.
Precisely.
Uh-huh.
He argues that sometimes respecting an animal's fundamental rights means we shouldn't be using them at all. Regardless of how kindly we might treat them during that use, that's a huge step.
Okay, let's dig into that a bit. You mentioned he starts with the science. What does the science actually tell us about animal consciousness? Because that's pretty crucial, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial. He grounds the whole ethical argument in empirical reality. He looks at the evidence from neuroscience, from animal behavior studies, from evolutionary biology.
And what's the conclusion?
For many animals, especially mammals and birds, the evidence for consciousness is, frankly, overwhelming. They have brain structures that are homologous to ours, similar structures performing similar functions.
Meaning they likely have similar basic experiences, pain, fear, maybe even pleasure.
That's the strong implication. Behaviorally, they show complex problem-solving, social interactions, signs of distress, and enjoyment. They're definitely not just simple stimulus-response machines.
So they're individuals with interests, things that matter to them.
Yes, and this leads to a really important distinction he makes early on. between moral agents and moral patients.
Okay, what's the difference?
Moral agents are beings who can understand and make moral decisions, who have duties and responsibilities. Think typical adult humans.
Got it.
Moral patients, on the other hand, are beings who maybe can't make those moral decisions, but they can be wronged. They can suffer harm, their interests can be violated, they are recipients of moral concern.
And most animals would fall into that category.
Clearly. They might not understand ethics, but they can certainly suffer if we harm them. They are moral patients, deserving of moral consideration and protection.
Right. So if sentience is the key criterion for being a moral patient, and science shows many animals are sentient, where does that lead us ethically? Where does it get uncomfortable?
It gets uncomfortable when we look in the mirror, when we realize how deeply inconsistent our behavior is. This is where DeGrazia introduces the concept of speciesism.
Speciesism is like racism or sexism, but based on species.
Exactly. It's discriminating against beings or favoring beings solely because they belong to a certain species in this case, usually favoring Homo sapiens. He argues it's just as morally arbitrary.
But wait a second. If we don't use species and instead use criteria like high-level rationality or language to decide who gets full moral rights, doesn't that create problems on the human side? What about humans who lack those abilities?
You've hit on precisely the point he wants us to confront. He uses a very powerful philosophical tool here known as the argument from marginal cases, or the AMC.
Marginal cases?
Yes. It goes like this. If you say that advanced cognitive abilities like rationality, autonomy, complex language are the necessary basis for having fundamental moral rights,
Okay. Then
logically you would have to deny those same fundamental rights to humans who lack those specific abilities. Think infants or people with severe cognitive disabilities. These are sometimes referred to as marginal cases in this specific philosophical context.
But we absolutely don't do that. We believe infants and those with severe disabilities have fundamental rights, the right not to be killed, not to be experimented on without consent, not to be made to suffer needlessly.
Exactly. And rightly so. The AMC exposes this huge logical inconsistency in traditional human-centered ethics. We protect vulnerable humans based on their capacity for sentience, their basic interest in avoiding pain and experiencing well-being.
Even if they don't have high intelligence or language.
Right. So DeGrazia asks, if that's our standard for humans who lack those advanced cognitive traits, how can we consistently deny similar basic protections to animals who often have similar or even greater capacities for sentience and experiencing the world than some of those marginal humans?
Wow. That's a tough inconsistency to defend.
It really is. It forces you to either accept that sentience is the real basis for fundamental moral protections, or bite the bullet and say that some humans don't deserve those protections, which almost no one is willing to do.
Okay, so once he's established that philosophical groundwork sentience as the key, the inconsistency of speciesism via the AMC, he applies it to specific areas. But let's talk about factory farming first. That seems like a major focus.
It is. And his analysis is stark. He details the conditions, the battery cages for hens, the gestation crates for pigs, the sheer scale of the suffering.
These are systems designed purely for efficiency, right? Not for animal well-being.
Pretty much. Maximum output, minimum cost, often with devastating consequences for the animal's most basic needs and desires. He argues the level of systematic suffering inflicted on literally billions of sentient beings is just staggering.
And how does he weigh that against the human benefit?
He argues it's wildly disproportionate, especially in affluent societies like ours. The benefit often boils down to what? Cheaper meat, convenience, or just, as he puts it, gustatory pleasure, the taste.
So the argument is that minor human interests like taste preference just cannot justify causing such profound and widespread suffering to sentient beings.
That's the core of it. Morally, he argues, it's indefensible. The ethical sums just don't add up.
He applies a similar lens to animal research, doesn't he? While acknowledging there have been benefits.
Yes, he acknowledges the benefits, which is part of his balanced approach. But he argues that a huge amount of current animal research simply fails to meet stringent ethical standards.
Meaning the potential benefit doesn't justify the harm caused to the animals?
Often, yes. Or that alternatives weren't properly considered. He's a strong advocate for rigorously applying the 3 R's framework, which is actually common in research ethics discussions.
The 3 R's, remind me.
Replacement. Using non-animal methods whenever possible. Think computer modeling, cell cultures, refinement modifying experiments and housing to minimize any pain or distress for the animals that are used, and reduction using the absolute minimum number of animals necessary to get statistically significant results.
So it's not necessarily an outright ban on all research, but a much, much higher ethical bar to clear before any animal is used.
Exactly. A far more stringent ethical calculus needs to be applied.
Okay, stepping back a bit, what are the really big overarching themes or messages you take away from de Grazia's work?
I think there are a few key ones. First, and most fundamental, is that sentience is the foundation. That capacity to feel is what makes a being matter morally. It's not about intelligence or language.
And reflecting on that, it really forces you to expand your circle of moral concern based on logic, not just emotion or tradition.
Precisely. The second big theme is rejecting speciesism. Recognizing that favoring our own species without a morally relevant reason is a prejudice, much like other prejudices we've fought against.
Yeah, and thinking about that makes you examine your own attitudes. Why do we feel so differently about causing pain to a dog versus, say, a pig, when their capacity to suffer might be quite similar?
It's that inherent bias we need to confront. Third, I'd say the integration of science and ethics. This isn't just philosophical navel-gazing. It's deeply rooted in what we know about animal minds from neuroscience, ethology.
Which makes the argument feel intellectually solid, not just an appeal to the heart.
Definitely. And maybe the fourth theme, which I think is really important, is practical implementation.
Right. You mentioned he's pragmatic.
Yeah, he's not demanding an overnight revolution. He understands social change is slow. So he calls for incremental progress, achievable reforms, banning the worst practices first, pushing for alternatives.
Which feels more empowering, right? It suggests you, the listener, can actually take meaningful steps, even if they seem small, rather than feeling like it's an all or nothing battle.
Exactly. It makes change feel possible.
De Grazia is also really good at phrasing things memorably. There are some lines or core ideas that really stick.
Yes, very clear.
Like the central point about sentience. The capacity for sentience is what makes a being a suitable candidate for moral consideration. That just nails the shift away from human-only traits.
It really does. And then there's the one highlighting our inconsistency, which is so powerful. Something like, we cannot coherently maintain that it is wrong to cause unnecessary suffering to dogs while simultaneously supporting practices that cause far greater suffering to pigs.
Oof. Yeah, that one hits close to home for many people. It directly challenges everyday choices.
It does. And finally, I think his clarification on what rights means is crucial, because people hear animal rights and think it means treating animals exactly like humans, which sounds absurd.
Right, giving cows the vote or something.
Exactly. But de Grazia clarifies. He says something like, animal rights do not require treating animals identically to humans, but they do require taking their interests seriously and not overriding their fundamental interests merely for human convenience or pleasure.
That's a much more reasonable and frankly achievable standard. Taking their basic interests like avoiding suffering seriously.
It's measured, it's practical, and it flows directly from the ethical framework he builds.
So how does this translate into real life? What are the applications?
Well, the most immediate impact is clearly on personal responsibility, particularly our choices about food and consumption.
Dietary choices, you mean?
Yes. The philosophy provides a strong rational basis, beyond just emotion, for reducing or even eliminating your consumption of factory-farmed animal products. And also being more conscious about seeking out cruelty-free goods, generally cosmetics, clothing, household items.
It becomes about aligning your actions with that principle of not causing unnecessary suffering for convenience.
Precisely. But it goes beyond personal choices, too. There's potential for institutional and policy impact.
That's so.
De Grazia's framework gives tools to people working within systems, vets, researchers, policymakers. They can use these ethical arguments to evaluate current laws, push for stronger oversight in labs, advocate for bans on particularly cruel farming methods like gestation crates or battery cages.
It provides the justification for reform.
Exactly. And even something like ethical pet ownership takes on a new dimension.
More than just feeding and walking.
Yeah. It encourages thinking about it as a deep commitment to the animal's well-being. Maybe choosing adoption from shelters over buying from breeders, especially those with known health issues caused by breeding for certain looks. Prioritizing the animal's actual health and psychological needs over just human preferences.
Interesting. So as we wrap up, what really stood out for you personally from this deep dive?
You know, for me, it was probably his concept of unequal moral consideration.
Unequal? How does that work?
He acknowledges that, look, a typical human life probably involves a richer tapestry of interests, experiences, and future possibilities than, say, a mouse's life. So in some sense, the human life might carry greater moral weight overall.
Okay.
However, and this is the crucial part, that difference in overall weight does not mean the mouse's basic interests, like its interest in avoiding pain and staying alive, count for nothing. It doesn't justify inflicting suffering on the mouse for trivial reasons.
Ah, so it's nuanced. It's not saying all lives are identical in value, but that basic interests deserve serious consideration regardless of the species.
Exactly. Yeah. It avoids simplistic equations, but still provides strong protection for animals' fundamental needs. That nuance makes the whole philosophy feel very grounded and practical, I think.
Yeah, that distinction is really important. For me, the lasting insight is how effectively de Grazia frames animal rights, not just as a matter of compassion, although that's part of it, but as a fundamental question of justice and moral consistency.
Right. It's about logic as much as empathy.
Exactly. It feels like extending our moral concern to sentient animals isn't some radical leap, but rather the next logical step in our species' ethical evolution, building on past movements against arbitrary discrimination.
That's a powerful way to put it. And, you know, he even points out that respecting animal rights often aligns with human self-interest, too. Think about the environmental impact of factory farming or the public health risks.
Good point. Reducing harm to animals can often benefit us as well.
So maybe that leads to our final provocative thought for you, the listener. De Grazia argues that morality and prudence can align here. Where in your own life do you already see your moral concerns about animals overlapping with what might also be beneficial for you or for society?
Something to think about as you go about your day.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.